Chapter 12, New Dads, Fatherhood as an Independent Social Institution. When the number on your phone is your child's elementary school, it doesn't matter what you're doing, you pick up. On multiple occasions, in order to take one of these calls, my wife had to step out of a business meeting in Paris or New York, told that one of our sons was sick or injured and needed to be picked up. She would politely remind the caller that her husband was listed as the first parent to call on such occasions. I was, after all, the stay-at-home parent, and just a mile away from the school. Actually, by the third or fourth time this happened, the politeness might have been wearing off. Eventually, the school got it. But it was a reminder that for all the distance we've travelled, we have much further to go in updating our model of fatherhood. The working mother is now the norm, observes Hannah Rosen. The stay-at-home father is still a front-page anomaly. In chapters 10 and 11, I offered some solutions to the structural problems faced by boys at school and by men in the labour market. Now I turn to the biggest challenge of all, which is to reconstruct the role of men in the family. Throughout this book, I've tried to resist the temptations of hyperbole. In general, I think that claims of a crisis are almost always overblown and usually invoked in the service of a partisan goal. But I do think that the loss of the traditional male role in the family has been a massive cultural shock, and one that has left many men reeling. The old model of fatherhood, narrowly based on economic provision, is unfit for a world of gender equality. It has to be replaced with a much more expansive role for fathers, one that includes a much bigger caring element and is on an equal footing with that of mothers. This, of course, does not mean that fathers no longer have a responsibility to provide in a material way. It just means that the responsibility is shared with mothers. The same, however, is true of providing care to children. This can and should be shared too. So while there's a huge challenge here, there's also a huge opportunity to broaden the very definition of what it means to be a father. Unfortunately, rather than being the subject of serious cultural attention, fatherhood has become another victim of the culture wars. Progressives resist the idea that fathers have a distinct role to play, afraid that this will somehow undermine mothers or belittle same-sex couples. So they recoil from any proposal that might smack of fathers' rights. Conservatives, meanwhile, lament an epidemic of fatherlessness, but simply want to restore traditional marriage with clear and separate roles for men and women. Even the idea of fathers as carers seems to be threatening to some on the political right. Witness the attack from Fox News host Tucker Carlson in October 2021 on Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation, for taking paternity leave, they call it. Piers Morgan made a similar jab at Daniel Craig when the James Bond actor was photographed carrying his baby, tweeting out, "Oh 007, not you as well. Hashtag papoose. Hashtag emasculated Bond." Contrast Ruth Bader Ginsburg's more evolved vision for an equal society. In 1975, she successfully argued the case of Weinberger versus Wiesenfeld before the Supreme Court. In a unanimous decision, the court declared it unconstitutional to give Social Security benefits to widows caring for children while refusing them to widowers. Ginsburg said that this was the case she was most proud to have argued, because it provided an opportunity to promote the care of two loving parents rather than just one. As far as Justice Ginsburg was concerned, to be a feminist meant supporting equal rights for fathers. In this chapter, I set out the evidence that fathers matter to children, including in some ways that are distinct from those of mothers. I then describe a new family model, one where the relationship between fathers and children is independent of the one between fathers and mothers. Direct dads. Finally, I outline a policy agenda to support direct fatherhood, including equal and independent parental leave, a modernized child support system, and father-friendly employment opportunities. These policies are intended to support the development of a new model of fatherhood, suited to a world where mothers don't need men, but children still need their dads. Dads matter. Fathers really came into their own about 500,000 years ago, when human brains had a growth spurt. The need for food, especially meat, to nourish new mothers and their babies increased dramatically. From this point on, as anthropologist Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy points out, it took about 13 million calories to rear a human from birth to nutritional independence. As she says, this is far more than a woman could provide by herself. If fathers wanted their children to survive, they had to stick around and provide for them. So they did. Fatherhood is a product of evolutionary selection. As such, writes Anna Machin, anthropologist and author of The Life of Dad, fathers are not mere adjuncts to mothers, occasional babysitters, or bag carriers. They are the consequence of 500,000 years of evolution, and they remain a vital part of the human story. Machin observes that while fathers and mothers can do many of the same things, dads are wired to make two distinct contributions: protection and teaching. Of course, their expression will vary by social context. To protect your child means something very different in 21st century New York than on the savannah 500,000 years ago. Fathers matter for their children's welfare in ways that are different from, but equal to, those of mothers. Engaged fatherhood has been linked to a whole range of outcomes, from mental health, high school graduation, social skills, and literacy, to lower risks of teen pregnancy, delinquency, and drug use. Three-year-olds with involved, supportive dads score more highly on tests of cognitive development. A study in the state of Georgia found that infant mortality rates were twice as high among children whose fathers were not listed on their birth certificate, a proxy for paternal involvement, after taking account of differences in health conditions and socioeconomic background. It's hard to pin down direct causal effects here. We can hardly remove or add fathers at random to children's lives in the name of social science. But as Harvard scholars Mark Graugraug and Hannah Riley Bowles write, the importance of engaged fatherhood is now undismissible in ways it was not in earlier decades. A 2016 overview of research on fathering relationships and outcomes, conducted by education scholar William Janes, concludes that the role of fathers in raising children is unique and can be distinguished in kind from the role of mothers in child-rearing. This is not breaking news to most of us. According to a Pew Research Center survey, most people, 64%, think that men and women have a different approach to parenting. And almost all of these, 89%, think this is either a good or neutral thing. I'm reminded of Pauline Hunt's classic ethnographic study of domestic work in an English village in the 1970s, where she found that without exception, men washed the windows outside, while women washed them inside. There was a sharp but equal division of labour, and perhaps a degree of specialisation in the tasks. But in the end, what mattered was that the windows got clean. Especially to teens. Many of us think of adolescence as a period to be survived by both adolescents and parents. But there's now growing recognition that the teen years are in fact a vitally important period of development. As the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine note in their 2019 report, the adaptive plasticity of adolescence marks it as a window of opportunity for change through which mechanisms of resilience, recovery and development are possible. Fathers have an especially important role to play in this period. In contrast to the early years, where nurture and attachment are key. Adolescence is a time when children are finding their own feet, testing boundaries, and starting to go their own way. Rob Palkovitz, professor of human development and family studies at the University of Delaware, suggests that fathers play a particularly important role in stimulating children's openness to the world, encouraging them to take risks and to stand up for themselves. Fathers who are engaged with their teenagers help to reduce harmful forms of risk-taking behavior, for example. Delinquency rates are lower among the adolescent children of involved fathers. These effects seem to last, too. 16-year-old girls who are close to their fathers have better mental health at the age of 33. Father involvement predicts stronger academic outcomes in adolescence, too. The teaching role of fathers really seems to kick in strongly during these years. Machin writes that many dads in the West really step into their role during late childhood and adolescence, particularly when the time comes to teach their children. It's that all-important role in preparing children to step into the big wide world. Overall, as the sociologist Kevin Schaefer writes in his book So Close Yet So Far, Fathering in Canada and the United States, there are substantial benefits associated with father involvement from birth to adolescence. An important question here, of course, is the extent to which the contribution of fathers is distinct from that of mothers, or indeed a second parent of any gender. The sociologist David Eggebien tackled this question using the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent to Adult Health, a representative survey of 20,000 young adults in the US. He examined how fathers' and mothers' engagement affects mental health, delinquency, and civil engagement in their teenage children. A quarter of the parental inputs had no impact. The other parental contributions were additive, redundant, or unique. Additive inputs were those where the contributions of each parent were positive and identical. 42% fell into this category. Redundancies with no additional benefit from the input of the second parent accounted for 12%. The remaining 22% were unique, with positive contributions only from the father or the mother. Specifically, Eggebien concluded that fathers appear to especially make unique contributions to the well-being of their children through their human capital, while mothers make unique contributions through their availability and closeness to their children. Dads teach, mums tend. Eggebien's results are convincing. He shows that there is considerable overlap in the contributions made by parents to the adolescent's well-being, and that two is often better than one. But he also shows that both mothers and fathers also bring something unique to the parenting enterprise. It's important to note here that in all these studies, it is the quality of the relationship between parent and child that is being measured: time, engagement, involvement, closeness, and so on. It doesn't make much sense from this perspective to divide fathers into a binary of present or absent, as if their role could be captured by simply taking attendance. What matters is the relationship between parent and child. The whole idea of an absent father becomes even more complicated if, as the masculinity scholars William Marsiglio and Joseph H. Pleck suggest, one broadens the concept from physical to psychological absence. One study finds that adolescents close to their non-resident fathers do better than those with resident fathers with whom they're not close, as measured by higher self-esteem, delinquency rates, and mental health. There is no residency requirement for good fatherhood. The relationship is what matters. Direct dads. Fathers matter to their children whether or not they are in a relationship with their mother. The goal, then, is to bolster the role of fathers as direct providers of care to their children, whether or not they are married to or even living with the mother. There is a role for policy here, and I'll get to that in a moment, but there's clearly a big cultural shift required on the part of both men and women. Catherine Eden and Tim Nelson spent 7 years interviewing 110 fathers, mostly unmarried, in low-income neighborhoods in Philadelphia and Camden, New Jersey. In their 2013 book, Doing the Best I Can, Fatherhood in the Inner City, they show that most fathers want involvement in their children's lives, but are stymied by their own problems, poverty, mental illness, crime, as well as legal and child support systems that seek primarily to extract money, and mothers who act as a gatekeeper to their children. In many ways, black fathers are leading the way here. They're currently more likely to be classified as non-residential fathers, 44% compared to 21% of white fathers. But they're also more likely than non-resident white fathers to be involved in their children's lives in various ways, including helping with homework, taking them to activities, and checking in with them on their day. As one study concludes, black non-resident fathers shared responsibilities more frequently and displayed more effective co-parenting than Hispanic and white non-resident fathers. As I showed in Chapter 3, there's a huge disconnect between obsolete mental models of fatherhood based on traditional family roles and the reality of modern societies and economies. Fatherhood matters just as much as ever in a world of women's economic independence, but necessarily in a reinvented form. The good news is that fathers can potentially have an even more fulfilling role with a much closer relationship with their children. The bad news is that in much of our society, men are a very long way from being able to occupy this role as new dads. A policy agenda to support the new direct model of fatherhood will have three elements. First, equal and independent paid leave eligibility. Second, a reformed child support system. Third, father-friendly employment opportunities. I'll describe each in turn. Paid leave for dads. Fathers and mothers should be legally entitled to 6 months of paid leave for each child. Ideally, this leave would offer 100% wage replacement up to median earnings, paid for by higher Social Security contributions from employers and employees. I've been arguing for equal leave for mothers and fathers my whole career. But the specific proposal made here closely matches the one made by scholars Janet Gornick and Marsha Myers in their 2009 essay, Institutions That Support Gender Equality in Parenthood and Employment. Gornick and Myers' aim was to create a set of institutions that would allow parents to spend real time caring for their children while also promoting gender equality. Their goal was a dual-earner, dual-caregiver society, including symmetrical contribution from mothers and fathers at home. I share these aspirations. This will seem like a radical proposal for three reasons. First, 6 months may seem a long period of paid parental leave, equivalent to the provision in only a few European countries. Second, replacing wages at or close to 100% is unusually generous. Third, the granting of 6 months use it or lose it leave, specifically for fathers, i.e. not transferable between parents, goes beyond anything offered by any nation thus far. I'll briefly defend each of these features. 6 months of leave is necessary to allow parents to spend meaningful time with their children without losing all connection to the labor market. Given that dual-earner couples are now the norm, I honestly think 6 months is a modest proposal. Our labor market has been fundamentally altered by women's dramatic entry into the workforce, but our welfare system trundles along almost as if nothing had happened. As the economist Heather Boucher writes, the world of work and the needs of families always seem to be in conflict, and it's been this way for decades. Generous wage replacement is also needed if both parents are to be able to actually take the time off. The most common reason parents give for not taking paid leave is that they cannot afford a drop in income. Parents with the fewest economic resources face the most financial pressure to return to work when they often want to be caring for their child. There are some encouraging moves at the state level. Oregon's new 12-week paid leave plan, for example, provides 100% wage replacement for workers earning up to two-thirds of the state average. It's also worth noting that 15 OECD nations now offer 90% replacement rates or higher for father-only leave, although for much shorter durations than the 6 months I propose here. Finally, granting non-transferable parental leave to fathers will encourage and allow men to become equal partners on the home front. To support a more direct model of fatherhood, we need to think of parental leave as an individual benefit rather than a family one. The evidence suggests that providing father-only use-it-or-lose-it leave policies significantly increases take-up rates among dads. But it is important to be honest about the trade-offs here. Making the full leave available only if both parents take it involves what Norwegian sociologist Arnlag Lira calls mild structural coercion. An alternative proposal would be to grant 12 months of paid leave and allow parents to share it between them as they choose. A compromise position would be to give fathers a shorter period of dedicated leave than mothers, which is the approach taken in countries like Norway as well as Quebec in Canada. I have changed my mind on this issue twice already over the course of my career, so I'm acutely aware of the arguments on both sides. One specific fear is that families where fathers have little or no contact with their children will only be able to access 6 months of leave, and these are mostly lower-income families. But I now believe that if we are serious about expanding the role of fathers, equal leave is essential. The signal policymakers need to send is that paternal care matters as much as maternal care. Anything short of full equality blunts that message. I also believe that until and unless fathers begin to take more time out of the labour market, progress on closing the gender pay gap will be achingly slow. There is no getting around it. If we want equality at work, we need equality at home. But this equality does not have to be measured every day, or even every year. When you have young children, people say, they'll be grown before you know it. No offense to my sons, whom I love dearly, but that is not how it felt to me. Sometimes it felt like time had stopped altogether. Parenting is a really long road. The average couple has two children with a gap of 2 or 3 years between them. That means it takes about 2 decades to get them from birth to adulthood. One modification I would therefore make to the Gornick and Myers plan is to make paid leave available to parents up until their child's 18th birthday, not up to the age of 8, as they propose. This is partly because of the evidence I've already summarized on the importance of adolescence as a critical developmental phase, a period that too often gets short shrift in public policy. Discussions of paid leave or flexible working too often assume that the main work of parenting is over by the time children start school. I agree with Gornick and Myers that the goal is a symmetrical contribution from mothers and fathers at home. But it is important that this symmetry can be achieved over a couple of decades rather than a couple of years. Asynchronous symmetry, if you like. Jules Pierri, co-founder and former CEO of The Grommet, describes family life as a ballet, and that she and her husband alternated who took the lead. That's how my wife and I did it too, although we'll say it rarely felt balletic. Even with equal access to paid leave, it is likely that mothers will choose to do more of the care in the very early years. Even after the huge rise in women's employment over recent decades, most mothers with children under the age of 3 are either out of the labour market or working part-time. By and large, this seems to be by choice. Over half of mothers working part-time, 54%, say that this is their preference at this point in their life, and 14% say they would prefer not to be in paid work at all. The remaining 33% would rather be in a full-time job. My observation is that mums are rarely annoyed at dads for doing less than half of the direct parenting when their children are very young, so long as he's working just as hard in other ways. When they get really irritated is when he is still doing less than his fair share many years later. Just because mums are better at breastfeeding a three-month-old does not mean they are better at making dentist appointments for a 13-year-old. The feminist writer Mary Daly politely calls this gender politics of family time. I presented evidence that fathers may in fact have some unique strengths when it comes to raising adolescents. And I can imagine a social norm developing where mothers and fathers contribute broadly equally to the care of their children, just not at the same time. Tots for mums, teens for dads. Child support, cash, custody, care. Virtually every legal and institutional arrangement governing these fathers' lives tell them that they are a paycheck and nothing more, write Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson in Doing the Best I Can. They go on, at every turn, an unmarried man who seeks to be a father, not just a daddy, is rebuffed by a system that pushes him aside with one hand while reaching into his pocket with the other. The laws governing family life have simply failed to keep pace with society. When parents are married, their rights and responsibilities to their children are clearly defined. If they divorce, there is a legal apparatus in place to determine custody arrangements, visitation rights, and financial obligations. Of course, there's often conflict between divorcing couples, but at least they each have legal standing with regard to their children. And in recent decades, family laws have shifted in a more egalitarian direction toward divorce. Courts are now obliged to treat mothers and fathers fairly in determining custody, and the usual legal standard is now the best interests of the child or children. As a result, there has been a dramatic shift towards joint custody arrangements. In a study of cases in Wisconsin, Maria Kansian and others show a decline in the proportion of mothers being awarded sole physical custody from 80% in 1986 to 42% in 2008. The share of equal custody arrangements, with children spending the same amount of time with each parent, rose from 5% to 27%. As Kansian and her co-authors write, the trend away from mother sole custody and towards shared custody is dramatic. Nationally, fathers now get about a third of the time with children after separation or divorce. These trends are extremely positive. The legal default ought to be shared custody, with children wherever possible spending equal time with each of their parents. The problem is that there are no similar laws for unmarried parents. In every US state, an unmarried mother is the presumed sole custodial parent. Unmarried fathers must first prove paternity. In married couples, this is assumed. And then petition for visitation and custody. For many fathers, this can prove a difficult process. In the meantime, the mother can choose to bar all access. Regardless of visitation rights, however, unmarried fathers will typically be obliged to pay child support, often at levels that low-income fathers, in particular, struggle to meet. Divorcing couples typically work out their arrangements as part of a single process. But for unmarried parents, child support payments are adjudicated entirely separately from custody and visitation rights. Married fathers are seen as three-dimensional beings. Unmarried fathers are seen as walking ATMs. In 2020, $38 billion was collected in child support, and an estimated $115 billion was owed in arrears. Some of the money collected from fathers doesn't even go to provide for their children. It goes to the government to help offset welfare costs, specifically temporary assistance for needy families, which undermines support for the whole system. In three states, Colorado, Minnesota, and Vermont, all child support now goes to the family rather than to the government. Time for the other states to follow suit. As one struggling father tells Timothy Nelson, "Whatever I produce, I give up. I try to be the best dad I can, afford the best things that I can, even at the sacrifice of myself. I pray and hope things change. But I'm tired of being at the bottom so long that you can't see the top no more. Child support payments should be set with greater sensitivity to a father's ability to pay, and considering their non-monetary contributions, including the direct provision of care for their children. Oregon, for example, has a parenting time credit that reduces child support payments made by a non-custodial parent if they spend more time caring for their children. The long-run goal ought to be to integrate child support decisions for unmarried parents into the legal process for determining custody and visitation arrangements. As Eden and Nelson write, "If we truly believe in gender equity, we must find a way to honor fathers' attempts to build relationships with their children, just as we do mothers, to assign fathers' rights along with their responsibilities." Father-friendly jobs. In their 1973 book, The Symmetrical Family, sociologists Peter Wilmot and Michael Young, famous for inventing the term meritocracy, wrote, "By the next century, with the pioneers of 1970 already at the front of the column, society will have moved from A, one demanding job for the wife and one for the husband, through B, two demanding jobs for the wife and one for the husband, to C, two demanding jobs for the wife and two for the husband. The symmetry will be complete." Well, sort of. I think a lot of women would argue that a couple of decades into the 21st century, we've gotten stuck at step B. In part, this is because labour market institutions have not adapted to a world without wives. Stay-at-home wives, that is. It is worth noting that in Young and Wilmot's symmetrical utopia, the standard work week will have been cut to just 3 days, leaving 4 days for family and leisure. You have probably noticed that this hasn't happened. In the US, average working hours have in fact barely declined in the last half century. In 2/3 of families, both parents are in paid work. Whether we like it or not, the family is now a labour market institution, and the labour market is a family institution. But so far, only the family has changed. Men, children, and women are all bending their lives and schedules to fit the largely unaltered demands of market work to that standard work day and the typical career path. I support efforts to increase access to childcare and provide after-school clubs and so on. But I do worry that the goal of public policy often seems to be to create work-friendly families rather than family-friendly work. As Claudia Golden writes, "We've reached an unprecedented era of equality between men and women economically, but our work and care structures are relics of a past when only men had both careers and families." Mothers are caught most painfully in this trap right now, but we should not assume that fathers are okay with the trade-offs. Twice as many fathers as mothers say they spend too little time with their children, 46% versus 23%. My proposals for paid leave are a step toward lessening these tensions. But jobs must change too. More options to work flexibly or part-time or from home can at least ease the trade-offs between earning and caring. The wholesale shift to remote work during the pandemic represents an unprecedented opportunity to modernize work. It remains to be seen if it will be seized upon. I hope so, not least for the sake of dads. 2/3 of fathers say that the pandemic brought them closer to their children. Surprisingly, the opportunities for flexible working seem to benefit men more than women during the pandemic, according to one study. As well as more flexibility in the day-to-day nature of jobs, career ladders need to be modernized. For many parents, scaling back on paid work doesn't just mean a temporary dip in income. It can also result in permanent damage to career prospects. This problem is worse in what Golden calls greedy jobs, which offer big financial rewards for putting in long and unpredictable hours. Law, finance, and management consulting are good examples. If you want to move up, you can't take time out. In these circumstances, it makes sense for one parent to stay on the ladder and maximize income, while the other steps back to do more on the home front. Usually, that is dad and mum, respectively. The career structure of these occupations doesn't just incentivize a sharp division of labor between parents, it virtually imposes it. It should be no surprise, then, that these are also the professions with the widest gender pay gaps. Women working in law and finance earn just 77 cents on the male finance dollar. 15 years after graduating from the University of Michigan with a law degree, 4 out of 5 men are working at least 45 hours a week, compared to only half the women. Almost 1 in 4 of the women were working part-time, compared to just 2% of men. But it doesn't have to be this way. There are non-greedy professions that still pay high wages, including engineering, technology, and pharmacy. These are also, not coincidentally, occupations with much smaller gender pay gaps. Taking account of hours worked, female pharmacists make 94 cents on the male dollar. So what has pharmacy done right that law and finance continue to do wrong? The key change has been to make it easier for one pharmacist to substitute for another. How many of us care if we see the same pharmacist when we go to pick up our prescription? We likely feel differently about our lawyer or financial advisor. But it is important to remember that pharmacies used to be like that too and had the gender pay gaps to match. A combination of corporate consolidation and technological advances has made it possible for information to be transferred from one pharmacist to the next when they change shifts. Crucially, this means there is almost no hourly wage penalty for part-time work in pharmacy. Earnings rise with hours in a virtually linear fashion. This is why Golden calls pharmacy a most egalitarian profession. Can law, finance, and consultancy follow the pharmacy path? Technology helps by dramatically reducing the cost of transferring information between client-facing staff. Some financial firms, consultancies, and legal companies have made some modest moves in the right direction, such as cutting back on weekend hours, insisting staff take their vacation allowance, and allowing more part-time options, such as a 4-day week. In 2016, Amazon announced the creation of teams where all members, including leaders, would work 30 hours a week for 75% of their current salary. The option to work part-time at the same rate of pay is important here, but it will be critical to ensure that opportunities for development and promotion are not lost. Somewhere between greedy jobs and the mummy track, there is a way of working, let's call it the normal people track, that allows flexibility for family responsibilities at various points along the career track without losing out on major opportunities in the future. But I think we should be realistic about what it will take to bring about change in these family-hostile professions, which is for talented workers to vote with their feet. Major employers are finding that, especially among younger workers, expectations of a better work-life balance are rising rapidly, ranked second only to salary in many surveys. The loss of female talent from the pipeline has prompted some remedial action, but as long as men continue to be willing to put in long and often unpredictable hours, the prospects for structural reform remain dim. There's a lot of discussion of the need for culture change in the workplace. This is important, for sure. Most American men say there is an unspoken rule in their workplace that fathers should not take their full entitlement to paternity leave. But the greedy job professions need more than a new ethos. They need to be re-engineered. I have described these changes as promoting father-friendly employment. It would, of course, be more accurate to describe them as parent-friendly. In the short run, they may in fact be most helpful to mothers. But I've chosen the label deliberately. A job that requires a man to work long hours to make good money is not father-friendly, at least not in the way I think fatherhood must now be defined. Even if it enables a man to fulfill a breadwinning role, it does so at the price of his parenting role. As Anne-Marie Slaughter, head of the New America Foundation, warns, progress will be slow if we continue to define the care problem as women's problem. To those of us blessed to be dads, fatherhood is a core component of our identity. I've argued here that it now needs to be a bigger social role too, one that is different from, but equal to, motherhood. Pro-social masculinity no longer means having to get married or having to be the main breadwinner, but it does require stepping fully into the role of father.